I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. For the second time in his presidency, Donald Trump hoisted Norway into the spotlight this week. This time, instead of it being an example of a preferred alternative to S-hole countries for immigrants, it was an example of a preferred alternative to Russia as a source of dirt on political opponents. He walked back those comments this morning. Heather Cagle of Politico joins us for a look behind some of this week's national headlines. Here in Maryland, Delegate Robin Lewis tells us about her experience in the Transit Challenge. And Justin Fenton talks about his new series in the Baltimore Sun, which examines the massive criminal enterprise undertaken by an elite unit of the Baltimore City Police Department. Plus, Indian and jazz music are fused when members of Rajas perform live in Studio A. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. It's the Midday News Wrap today. In international news, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that Iran was behind the attacks on two ships in the Gulf of Oman yesterday, the second such attack in 2 months. Protests in Hong Kong against a bill allowing China to extradite people from Hong Kong turned violent this week, and the NBA champions are for the first time Canadian, sort of. The Toronto Raptors beat the Golden State Warriors last night to move the NBA crown outside of the U.S. for the first time. President Donald Trump began this Flag Day with an appearance on Fox and Friends in which he backtracked from his comments to George Stephanopoulos earlier in the week. He said this morning that he, quote, absolutely would report any information he received from a hostile power to law enforcement. Yesterday, a barrage of bipartisan criticism of the president included a comment from Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who said Trump simply didn't know right from wrong. Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced that she's leaving her post as White House spokesperson at the end of the month. The office in charge of monitoring compliance with the Hatch Act, which prohibits government employees from political activity on government time, suggested that presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway be relieved of her duties right away for repeated violations of that law. A little later in the program, we'll look at some local stories, but we begin today with Heather Cagle, who covers Congress for Politico. She joins us on the line from her office in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Heather, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And listeners, if you have a question for Heather, she covers Congress, as I mentioned, for Politico. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. So let's start, Heather, with the president's comments to George Stephanopoulos a couple days ago about his seeming okayness with taking information, dirt on political opponents from foreign nationals. How were those remarks interpreted at the time? What did he say this morning to walk back from those remarks?
You know, so yesterday, so the interview aired Wednesday night, and then yesterday we were on the Hill, and I think lawmakers and both Republicans and Democrats were very surprised by the comments, and I even talked to a few Democrats who are used to responding to Trump's most controversial remarks and criticizing them, and they told me that they were floored and that they even had to watch the video themselves to make sure that he said it. Now, the remarks prompted, as you mentioned earlier, criticism from across the aisle. A lot of Senate Republicans, including some of his allies, like Senator Lindsey Graham, spoke out against the president's remarks and said, no, you cannot accept assistance from a foreign government. And yes, if they offered it to you, you should absolutely immediately report it to the FBI. And then we had Democrats like Speaker Pelosi say the same. The question on the House side was, does this change the calculus for Democrats on impeachment and all, and whether they should start pursuing that? And we talked to nearly two dozen of them yesterday morning, and the answer was mostly everyone stayed in the camp that they're already in. And even Pelosi was asked about this during her press conference yesterday, and she said to the press, she said, you know, look, what he said is appalling. I can't believe it. It's outrageous. But he makes a string of appalling comments, and there's not just one that I'm going to wake up and it's going to trigger, in my mind, impeachment. So then fast forward to today, we saw President Trump on Fox and Friends in a nearly an hour-long interview about a lot of things, but on this, he basically walked it back, and I think he said, of course, he would alert the FBI if, you know, a foreign government approached him. But he also had this interesting caveat that said, but you have to look at what they're giving you, because if you don't look at it, you won't know if it's bad or not. So he is walking it back, but in a very Trump way of doing that, without apologizing or saying that he made a mistake in making the comments in the first place.
And it really is the case, as it does seem to be the case, that there isn't going to be sort of one tipping point. There isn't going to be one comment, one action, one piece of behavior on the part of the president that's going to somehow just have everybody throw up their hands, and not just the Democrats, and say, oh my gosh, we just can't put up with this anymore. It's time to begin an impeachment inquiry. I mean, is that what you're hearing from folks on the Hill?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen this throughout Trump's presidency. He has repeatedly upended what we have known in Washington for a long time as like conventional norms that both Republicans and Democrats ascribe to. And this is one of them. I mean, both folks on either side, either party, if you were to ask them before the president made these comments, you know, if you received an offer of assistance in an election from a foreign government, what would you do? I think you would mostly receive the same answer from Republicans and Democrats on the Hill, which is, I would alert the FBI and say, no, thank you. But these comments left kind of Republicans struggling to criticize the president without criticizing the president. And House Republicans even in some ways tried to defend the president by turning the onus on Democrats and saying they're the ones who haven't done enough to reject foreign interference in elections. So it was an interesting, strange turn of events yesterday. But on the impeachment inquiry, I really think what Democratic leaders, particularly Speaker Pelosi, was getting at yesterday, and what she's paying the most attention to, is public support for impeachment. And we saw a poll from Quinnipiac come out earlier this week that basically said there's only something like 30% of folks support moving towards impeaching the president. And that, for her, says everything. She has always said, and she frequently quotes Abraham Lincoln and says, public sentiment is everything. And what she means by that is, without the public on their side, in her mind, there's no point in doing it, because Republicans in the Senate would not move to convict Trump. So even if Democrats in the House impeach the president, he would not be removed from office. And in her mind, why would you do that when you can just repeatedly make the case against why the president is unfit for office and convince voters to elect a Democrat in 2020? That is her ultimate strategy, and that is what she would like to see happen.
And your colleagues, Natasha Bertrand and another colleague at Politico, had a piece about the effect of Mr. Trump's comments on the FBI. Mr. Trump going so far as to say that Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, was simply wrong in his assessment that that cooperating or taking information from a foreign government regarding an election campaign was not right. The head of the Federal Election Board had a tweet last night that said, I can't believe I have to say this, but no, you're not allowed to do that. Where do you think this leaves people in the intelligence community and people at the FBI? Do they, in fact, interpret this as an open invitation to foreign governments, hostile or friendly, to participate in our electoral process?
You know, I think that's a great question, and it's something we have seen the president obviously spar with the intelligence community for the entirety of his presidency, and repeatedly question their reports, and sometimes put, you know, what we have typically considered foreign adversaries, their accounts. He seems to publicly, at least, endorse their accounts more than our own, you know, domestic intelligence agencies. So this is just kind of the latest in a long-running, I don't know if I would call it a feud, but it's definitely a different take from the White House on U.S. intelligence. I definitely think that they will be more alert, and we have seen some folks on the Hill call to, like, push forward bills that would try to prevent and catch this foreign interference in the future, and also make it, since it's, I mean, it already seems to be clear, like you said, the Federal Election Commissioner put out the statement last night that said 100% this is illegal, do not do this. But, you know, the House Democrats yesterday were talking about, are there ways that we can underline this, highlight this, and, you know, make, you know, increase the punishment if someone were to do this. Now, House Democrats are saying that they're going to push these kind of bills to strengthen the areas and prevent foreign election interference, but they're unlikely to go anywhere in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. Senator McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, he's already shot down Democratic proposals that they passed in the House earlier this year relating to the elections and voting systems and things like that. He's called it a power grab, so he's unlikely to take up these proposals, but we will see them move through the House, which allows Democrats to put the spotlight back on these comments that President Trump made.
You have been paying attention to the crisis at the border and the legislative remedies that the House and the Senate are considering, and the Democrats are having a tough time coming to a consensus about how exactly to respond to the crisis. Do you think, in a general way, there's even consensus that what's going on in the border with increased families in particular coming across the border from Central America and Mexico, are people comfortable with even labeling it a crisis?
That's a great question, because we've definitely seen an evolution on the Hill with Democrats and Democratic presidential candidates who at first resisted calling it a crisis, because I don't think they wanted to give any credence to President Trump's claims, because they felt that much of what was happening at the border, he was causing. But now, in recent weeks, we've seen Democrats become much more comfortable with calling it a humanitarian crisis, which is their way of phrasing it, and that's particularly important because they're saying, yes, there are these awful things that are happening at the border, especially with children and family separation, children sleeping on floors and, you know, outside, and all kind of overcrowding, all kinds of humanitarian issues, and we absolutely need to address that. And I think that they are, you know, acknowledging what's happening at the border without giving Trump any kudos and saying he was the one that was right here, anything like that. So what we're seeing is, both in the House and Senate, they're trying to come to some kind of deal. The administration made a request last month for about $4.5 billion in supplemental funds to address this crisis at the border. And we initially thought in May that it was going to get tacked on to this massive disaster aid bill that was moving through both the House and the Senate right before they left for Memorial Day. But there were disagreements on both sides. Particularly Hispanic lawmakers in the House had issues with some language that would provide additional funding for beds, which they call derisively deportation beds. They say the administration is going to use them just to hold more people that they plan on deporting and not use them to address the overcrowding and, you know, the children having to sleep outside in tents and things like that. And so they wanted stricter language on that. The administration pushed back, and congressional leaders weren't able to reach a deal. So they tabled the supplemental talks, pushed through the disaster aid package, and now we're back at it. So I think congressional leaders are still hoping to pass something to give border funding for this border crisis before the July 4th recess, which is in 2 weeks. But as you mentioned earlier, they're still having a hard time reaching agreement on the final details. So it really remains to be seen whether they can get this together in the next 2 weeks.
Does the fact that Mexico appears to have appeased the president in their promises to take stronger action preventing migration from Mexico into the United States from non-Mexican nationals, how does that play into this thing? Of course, we have the president, you know, threatening tariffs on Mexico if they didn't stop the flow of migrants coming across the border. They seem to have reached some sort of agreement, although there are those who think that most of the things in that agreement had long ago been agreed to. But how is that informing any of the conversations about this in Congress?
I think, honestly, it doesn't make the negotiations on the Hill any less urgent, because they see, and just from talking to lawmakers across the Capitol this week, they see the crisis that is happening now. And so although Mexico has agreed to try to curb migrants from crossing the border in the future, whether that agreement was reached long ago or whether it was part, you know, to stave off these tariffs with Trump, either way, they say we still need to funnel this money down there now to address the migrants that are there and that are suffering. And so I think there's still, you know, sometimes Congress doesn't work well unless it has a deadline. I think they still feel like this deadline is on them, and they still really do want to get this done by July 4th, because once we come back in July, we have about 3 weeks. They want to pass a bunch of larger funding bills to fund the rest of the government, and then they're gone in August for 6 weeks. So they really kind of, a lot of congressional leaders think that this now is the time to get this done, or else, you know, it may not get done for a long time.
The enmity between the democratically controlled House and the White House continues unabated. We've got the specter of contempt votes for William Barr and Wilbur Ross, Attorney General and member of the cabinet. We've got a report from the Office of the Special Counsel, unrelated to Robert Mueller, is a different Office of the Special Counsel. They monitor the Hatch Act, and they've recommended that Kellyanne Conway be relieved of her duties. We just got a minute left or so. What does that mean?
Well, they basically said that she should be fired because of numerous violations of using her. They accused her of using her public office numerous times for political gains, mostly by criticizing Democratic candidates from her perch at the White House, which, you know, is not allowed. The next thing to look for on this front, Congressman Elijah Cummings, who's chairman of the House Oversight Committee, said that he would hold a hearing on this on June 26th with the Office of the Special Counsel to talk about its findings and go over its recommendations. And he has invited Conway to testify. I am going to just take a bet here, go out on a limb, and say she's unlikely to testify, just given the White House's lack of cooperation with House Democrats generally. But when she was asked about it yesterday at the White House, she did not answer the reporters.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Heather, that's for sure. Heather Cagle covers Congress for Politico. I very much appreciate it. Have a great weekend. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. You too.
Up next, Justin Fenton of the Baltimore Sun takes us inside the Gun Trace Task Force, an elite group of Baltimore police officers who have all been sentenced to prison for their involvement in a huge criminal conspiracy that went undetected for years. Plus, Delegate Robin Lewis will talk about her experience with the transit challenge. Before we go to a quick break, Maryland Matters is reporting this morning that former Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates R. Clayton Mitchell Jr. died yesterday. The Kent County Democrat served as Speaker from 1987 to 1992. First elected to the House in 1970, Mitchell was appointed Chairman of the Appropriations Committee in 1983. He succeeded Ben Cardin as Speaker when Cardin was elected to Congress in 1986. Clayton Mitchell was 83 years old. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. By the way, coming up Monday, a conversation about transportation. We make it a habit to check in with transit officials from the city and state, as well as transit advocates, to assess the state of public transportation in the Baltimore region. And in advance of that conversation on Monday, my next guest is Delegate Robin Lewis, who represents the 46th Legislative District in the Maryland House. The 46th includes Cherry Hill, Federal Hill, Patterson Park, Harbor East, Little Italy, McKeldry Park, Highland Town. In other words, all the neighborhoods here in our city that kind of touch the water. Although she represents Baltimore, she has joined with Montgomery County officials who were asked by transit advocates to spend 1 week using only public transportation. Delegate Lewis joins us on the line from Little Italy. Delegate, good afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be with you.
So what are the folks in Montgomery County trying to accomplish?
Their goal was to highlight the poor level of investment in transit infrastructure in their own area. So the Montgomery County Council was challenged to use mass transit to get around. That way, with their platform, they could experience transit, talk about it, raise awareness, and hopefully draw attention to opportunities for improving what they've got going on there. And for me, I thought that was fantastic. I also knew that there was nothing like that happening here in Baltimore City. Nobody challenged elected officials here to step up to the plate, take the challenge, experience what it's like to use our public transportation system. I thought, if my friends in Montgomery County don't mind, I'm just going to hijack their exercise and do a transit challenge in Baltimore.
You know, and this is something that I've actually been talking about for about 10 years. I've said I think it would be a great idea if the folks in the Maryland House and Senate experienced what it meant to ride the bus or take public transit for a week. I thought everybody should throw their keys into a big bucket and then, you know, pick them up a week later. So your experience, however, this is not something new for you because you have been without a car for a while. I mean, what's your experience been this week? Because what's been fun is that you've been documenting it on social media.
Yeah. So it's always fun to tell stories about what life is really like. Folks are always curious what it means to be an elected official. What do you do all day? And what do you do when you're not in session? Well, what I do is spend an inordinate amount of my mental bandwidth calculating how I'm going to get from one commitment to the next. I'm car-free by choice. I've been car-free by choice here in Baltimore for almost 5 years. I'm an American. I got my driver's permit at the age of 15, like everyone else. I spent most of my childhood being driven a great distance to school in a very fancy car, but I've never enjoyed having to drive, and I particularly resent it when I live in a city, a dense, very old and walkable city, but I can't get around without a car. So for years, after moving to Baltimore in 1999, I survived for about 1 year without a car, finally broke down, had to buy one, resented every minute of it, and I hated the money I had to spend to own the car, insure the car. And insurance rates are very high where I live because I live in an area that's been redlined historically and has challenges, and so they charge us unbelievable amounts of money. In any case, in 2014, on the eve of the construction of the Red Line, if you remember, Tom, we were all looking forward to the most important and significant transit infrastructure investment in Baltimore City in more than a generation.
We certainly were.
I got rid of my car because I thought any day now I'll be able to hop on fantastic modern fixed rail, get to most of my destinations much more easily. Who needs this doggone car?
And
unfortunately, not long after I got rid of my car, the governor canceled the Red Line without consultation, but I decided I hated owning a car. I hated the burden. I really resented the expense. So I've been car-free ever since. This is just a regular week for me. The difference is I'm sharing my story with all of you.
We just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, has the transit system improved over the last couple of years? Because the governor has suggested that the changes they made to, for example, the bus system here in Baltimore have made it better. Has that been your personal experience?
That's true to an extent. I will say I'm incredibly fortunate because I live close to downtown. Most of my everyday trips are short. I am able to use the bus, and there are some improvements in frequency for the bus lines that I use. But I'm lucky. I live downtown. For people who live at the periphery, it's still unacceptable. I had a commitment that required me to go to Northwest Baltimore the other day, the Liberty Heights area. The only way I could have gotten there by bus would have required a 1 hour, 30-minute one-way trip. That's unacceptable. Northwest Baltimore to have some of the highest rates of unemployment. One of the reasons is because poor transit. The biggest obstacle to employment is commute time. We know that. And until we invest, make it easier for people to connect with opportunity, education, employment, we'll continue to have a lot of the challenges. And I think that was an important part of my story this week.
Delegate Robin Lewis represents Baltimore in the Maryland House. We'll have more on the state of public transportation in Baltimore here on Midday Monday. Delegate, I heartily congratulate you on what you're doing and calling attention to this, and I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
In other local news this week, Governor Larry Hogan appointed 11 new board members to oversee the University of Maryland medical system. Critics were disappointed that Mr. Hogan brought back from their leaves of absence four of the members of the UMMS board who served during the scandal that led to the resignation of former Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh. The California consulting firm that UMMS commissioned to do an inquiry into that scandal determined that there were numerous instances of no-bid contracts handed out to members of the UMMS board without the knowledge of most board members, but with the knowledge of at least one board member who himself was the recipient of one of those no-bid deals. And Baltimore County Executive Johnny Olszewski Jr. announced yesterday that the show will go on at Oregon Ridge Park the night before the 4th of July. Musicians of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra will play an Independence Day extravaganza concert with support from Baltimore County and the Musicians Performance Trust Fund, which was established to make live music accessible to audiences around the country. We turn now to Baltimore Sun reporter Justin Fenton. His three-part series about the Baltimore City Police Department's notorious gun trace task force was posted a couple of days ago on the Sun's website. You can see it in the hard copy of the paper this Sunday, the first part of it. It's called Cops and Robbers and explores how a group of rogue police officers ran an extensive criminal enterprise for years undetected. Eight former officers have been sentenced to jail terms ranging from 7 to 25 years, and a ninth officer who worked in Baltimore but was more recently in the Philadelphia Police Department was also convicted and sentenced to jail. Justin Fenton joins me here in the studio. How you doing, man?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This series is terrific, and to see it online with the video components that you have in the photographs and the way it's laid out is really just remarkable. But and you spent, I guess, about a year looking into this?
Yeah, after the trial, you know, we had written so many stories about this case, about the trial, about, you know, sort of sub-stories. And I think there was a thought that, you know, there was much more to say, that there was a lot of questions about sort of how could this have happened, who knew, who should have known, you know, what sort of culture is in the police department that allows something like this to flourish. So I really sort of tried to slow down. I think I've been a pretty prolific reporter for the Sun over the years, and I sort of took a beat and tried to dig into this and find out as much as I could.
The Gun Trace Task Force was, in fact, very successful for a long time. I mean, this was considered an elite unit because they were delivering on what they promised.
Yeah, one of the things I try to highlight, too, is that, you know, these officers were doing this before they came together in the Gun Trace Task Force, that Wayne Jenkins in particular, the sergeant who's serving 25 years right now, that he was really viewed within the police department, within the state's attorney's office, is one of the best officers that they had, and he did a good job of towing that line. There were questions raised over the years, and we get into that in the story, trying to explain so what happened when questions were raised, but they were valued for their stats and for the productivity, especially when crime spiked in 2015.
Because one of the questions you ask is this a matter of the higher-ups, the command structure of the Baltimore City Police Department, ignoring what they knew was going on or being clueless as to what was going on? Ultimately, having been so close to the story for such a long time, what do you think the answer to that is?
I think it's clear that they probably looked the other way on questions that were being raised. You know, these allegations of robberies, of, you know, stealing tens of thousands of dollars at a time and drug dealing. I wasn't able to find evidence that people knew about that, but there were certainly major red flags repeatedly that I think were tolerated because the officers were good at getting guns and drugs off the street. And people weren't really analyzing how did they do it, you know, and following up on the fact that a lot of these cases really didn't last in court. They were thrown out.
My guest is Justin Fenton. He's a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. His three-part series called Cops and Robbers was posted online Wednesday on the Baltimore Sun website. If you have a question for Justin Fenton about the Gun Trace Task Force, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. You write about how the sort of modus operandi of Wayne Jenkins and the people in this Gun Trace Task Force really was a very good business model, because the people that they were going after were themselves compromised in a legal way. So they were relying on the fact that if they're robbing from a drug dealer, the drug dealer has his own motivation to not go to authorities and to not sort of, you know, pursue a remedy under the normal means.
Yeah. I mean, there were few documented incidents where people had actually complained, but there were instances where people did complain. And I think that the authorities at the time had a very difficult time believing those allegations, sort of proving them. There was a case that we document in 2014 where there seems to be clear evidence on video of something that is not true that the officer said. But they sort of find themselves, we have a conversation among prosecutors saying, how are we going to get this guy? What are we going to do? and they ultimately decided they can't do anything. But Jenkins did get flagged for punishment in that case, and the deputy commissioner at the time, who went on to be the commissioner, who's now in federal prison, intervened and actually—
Darryl D'Souza.
Yeah, it's been said that he intervened and sort of got rid of the punishment. But I wanted to spotlight this plainclothes culture of the department because it's beyond this unit. You know, these officers are sort of, you know, told that you can work in this gray area. You know, you're not responding to 911 calls. You can use informants. You can let people go. You can, you know, do all sorts of surveillance techniques. And there's not a lot of accountability there. There's not a lot of proof of what they're doing when it comes to court. And it gives, if someone wants to exploit that, a tremendous amount of latitude to misrepresent things.
Now, plainclothes police officers are different than undercover police officers, and you make that clear in the story. Undercover, you sort of infiltrate a group. You get them to think that you're one of them. These are police officers, but they don't drive in marked cars, and they don't wear police uniforms, but they carry guns, and they, as you say, you know, do surveillance, and they have discretion to, you know, maybe let somebody go to get a bigger fish or to wait and see what happens at a later date. But Kevin Davis, a former police commissioner, whom you quote, say that plainclothes police officers made the most arrests and they seized the most drugs and money. So in terms of a police technique, a plainclothes contingent in the force seems to be really necessary.
Well, over the years, the department has absolutely relied on this type of policing, and it's also been the one that over the years routinely is the ones that there's misconduct allegations being made, there's indictments coming out of them, and the department has not wanted to wrestle with sort of, you know, do we have a major problem here? And I think it's clear that there is. But what I found interesting was when I talked to former police leaders who sharply criticized this culture, outsiders who came in and said, this is all wrong, this is really bad, they still say that it has to exist in some fashion. That's why we had a follow-up story that ran yesterday where we asked Michael Harrison, you know, should we still have this with all the stuff that's gone on? Can we still have plainclothes policing? And he said yes. He thinks that, you know, if we rein them in, if there's proper supervision, proper training, this type of policing is good. I think that people in the community hear that and think, you know, this is going to be more of the same. So, you know, we have to see how we can, if this can be moderated.
You also mentioned the fact that Baltimore is not the only city to have trouble with plainclothes police officers and units. You mentioned Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Chicago. I mean, there are other places where corruption has been rampant in these units in particular. So even with all of that, police officials like Mr. Harrison, for example, our current chief, seem to be very wed to the idea that there's no other way to do it. I mean, have they given you, has anybody suggested to you that there are alternatives to finding out the kind of information? I mean, this gun trace task force was supposed to literally take guns off the street. Is there a better way, an alternative way that's equally effective?
You know, it's funny. The Baltimore City Police Union actually in 2012 had said, we have too many specialized units. We need to have more in patrol. So there are people who have been advocating that even from within the police department. We also spoke with, you know, reform-minded police leaders like the chief in Charlottesville, Virginia, who says, I got rid of them. We can't have them. But I think a lot of folks think that there's a role for it. It's needed. You know, when people say the crime is too high, we have to do something about it. You know, the sentiment is that the patrol officers aren't going to be the ones who stumble onto the types of things that the plainclothes officers do, and that we still need to have these units. But again, over the years, there's been many, many examples of why this is problematic, and they have not been able to fix it.
So Wayne Jenkins led this group, and they would bust drug dealers. They would take the drugs, and instead of bringing them to the evidence room, they would sell them. Mr. Jenkins had a colleague in this enterprise, a bail bondsman, who would sell the drugs, and they would split the proceeds for that. And sometimes they would find large troves of cash, and they would just simply take the cash without bringing it in. And he did this for years and years and years. How did they finally decide that Mr. Jenkins was a problem? I mean, by the time they arrested him, they had been looking into his actions for quite a while.
Well, I mean, as we've reported, I mean, this squad was taken down by essentially an accidental wiretap investigation of a drug crew. They were listening to a drug dealer's phone. He was in communication with an officer who was a member of the Gun Trace Task Force. Wayne Jenkins was not a member of the Gun Trace Task Force at that point. Had he not been transferred to the unit in June of 2016, which the investigation was about 3 months in at that point, he might not have been detected, and that's sort of a scary thing. Body cameras were sort of new at that point, so you know it remains an open question of whether body cameras might have caught him slipping at some point, but this was sort of the authorities kind of fell backwards into this case. I want to highlight one thing. In part two of the series, we take a look at the body camera footage of the officers. We obtain all the footage that they recorded, and I think it was very instructive in terms of, you know, the officers didn't put their robberies and stealing drugs on body camera, but the stuff they did put on body camera was deeply troubling. The very same day that the Justice Department's civil rights investigation of the police department came out, that had this searing findings that they
were. And that was in 2016.
2016, in August 2016, this report comes out that says police are routinely violating people's rights. They're making disproportionate traffic stops of black people, improper searches. The guys hit the street that night, and there's like 10 clips of body camera footage where they are pulling people over in black neighborhoods for seatbelt violations, and then they're searching their cars. You know, that is something that I think
without warrants,
and you know, there's this escalation where the officers are trained, and it is mostly legal to pull people over for a moving violation, and then sort of ask them, "Can I search your car?" And people feel like they can't say no. They say you're acting nervous. You know, the person may or not be. That is a subjective thing. They say that they smell marijuana. There's no smell-o-vision on these body cameras, so they say these things, and they ratchet these minor stops up into the point where they are inside somebody's car. And, you know, in a lot of these videos, they didn't find anything. And so you had people getting pulled out of their cars, sometimes on the lot of a gas station, for not having a seatbelt on. And the officers are searching them, letting them go. Now, we don't typically hear about that kind of stuff, or we don't get to see it, rather. And we were able to see it. And I wanted to show that to people so they can fully understand what people in certain neighborhoods in the city have been complaining about for a very long time.
And in terms of checks and balances, one of the other things that makes it so stark and amazing that Jenkins and the others were able to act as they did for as long as they did, some 40% of the cases in which Mr. Jenkins was involved were dropped by prosecutors. I mean, it was not effective policing.
Right. You know, the police department, when you get a gun, they say, great job. And they tweet a picture of the gun, and everybody says, okay, now go get some more tomorrow. And these cases weren't good. And they were getting thrown out, and prosecutors weren't doing follow-up, and the police department wasn't doing follow-up. There was a program created within the police department to try to do just that. And the former inspector general, he's not there anymore, he told me, you know, we just didn't have the resources for it. There wasn't a will to do it. Our staffing is such a problem, and the crime fight. Everybody said, we got to tackle a crime issue today. And every day they're putting out all these fires and these follow-up things. I mean, all roads lead back to the lack of follow-up, and the department is very much in a right now mindset, and so are the prosecutors. I asked them, are you doing those types of reviews? And they said, well, you know, we flag cases if we see misconduct, certainly, but like, what about like the fact that officers are routinely making a bad search? What about the fact that they're routinely, you know, documenting their evidence poorly? Is anyone taking a holistic view of that? And the answer was no.
You've covered the police department for a long time. There are an awful lot of people who place a great deal of hope in the figure of Michael Harrison, the new police chief. They point to the fact that he was able to turn things around in terms of corruption in the New Orleans Police Department, another city that had a high crime rate, a majority African-American city. The similarities are multiple. Do you share their optimism? Do you think, given what's happened with the Gun Trace Task Force, what's happened with, you know, the specter of one of the police chiefs now, as you mentioned, serving time for tax evasion, all of the upheaval, the fact that we, you know, had a mayor leave office under a cloud of corruption, do you share an optimism about Michael Harrison's capacity to turn this thing around?
I think he's shown in New Orleans that he was able to turn things around there. The difference was he was from there. He was working within an organization that he was used to. His challenge is going to be, and this is what Kevin Davis and Jerry Rodriguez, a former deputy commissioner from Los Angeles, they said that they felt like they had such a uphill battle and a constant fighting with folks who had come up through the agency about saying this is the way we do things here, and that they did not have enough support. I think that Harrison has brought in some outsiders. Very interestingly, he has many civilians in key positions, which I think is going to be interesting to watch. But that is what I've been told is going to be a major, major challenge for him.
Justin Fenton covers the Baltimore Police Department for the Baltimore Sun. His series on the Gun Trace Task Force is called Cops and Robbers. We'll have a link to the series on our website, wypr.org/midday. This is terrific work, Justin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break, a live performance by the acclaimed Indian percussionist and composer Rajna Swaminathan. Stay with us.